Welcome to Preaching and Preachers, a weekly podcast devoted to those who preach and to the task of preaching itself. I'm your host, Jason Allen, president of Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. Today, I want to welcome Dr. Ray Van Ness to the podcast. Dr. Van Ness serves as assistant professor of Christian studies, as well as director of the R.C. Ryan Center for Biblical Studies at Union University in Jackson, Tennessee. Today, we're doing something new on the podcast. We're introducing a recurring series on preaching certain books in the Bible or certain genres of literature. Today with Dr. Van Est, I'll be talking about preaching the pastoral epistles, three books of the Bible he's very familiar with, has written much on. So Dr. Van Est, welcome to Preaching and Preachers.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, as I read your bio, I said assistant professor of Christian studies. Is that accurate?
It's not. Some of the language has been changed, so it's now professor of biblical studies.
Okay, that's what I thought. I thought the assistant was dated because you've been there quite some time now. Well, hey, listen, speaking of having been there quite some time now, tell us about what's new at Union University, your role there, what God's doing on the campus, and what you find yourself teaching and engaging in day to day.
Things are rolling along nicely in an encouraging way. Some of the biggest news on campus continues to be our new library, and it's a great place to study and check out. I'm enjoying my classes there. This semester I'm teaching two Old Testament surveys and Pauline epistles. Next semester I'll have a New Testament survey and my pastoral ministry class, and then also teach elementary Greek. That's a great fun one for me, and our Johannine literature class.
Good. So you have a lot going on. And man, you're keeping up with it all. I'm impressed you can name what you're teaching and going to teach all at one time. Good for you. Well, listen, we consider our friends at Union to be colleagues in a great work, gospel work, ministerial work, and what the Lord has done at Union over the past generation and currently. It just encourages so many of us. So thank you for your part there.
Thank you.
And please tell our many friends we said hello and Godspeed and press on.
Thank you. Well, we'll definitely do that.
So we're talking about the pastoral epistles today. And before we hop into that topic, give us a little bit of a sense of your journey. I know your journey, but that's for our listeners, primarily pastors and ministers and men and women preparing for ministry. How did you become a pastoral epistle scholar?
Well, this beginning with a call to ministry, and right after my, or during my senior year in high school, moving into some ministry settings and seminary and figuring out what that's going to be like, what am I going to primarily do. I found myself at Trinity Seminary and pastoring a church there, and that was a great confluence. To be in seminary and serving at the same time meant a lot, and I was trying to think about what I was going to write for my master's thesis that would be required. And I can remember sitting at my desk in our basement in our little duplex doing sermon preparation. And for some reason, I don't remember what the reason was, I was preaching through Titus. And as I was doing the sermon preparation, I began to see some things in the structure of the letter that seemed interesting. It seemed to help understand what was going on in the letter. And I didn't see it talked about in the commentaries. I realized later I wouldn't see in all the commentaries, especially some German ones. But this just piqued my interest because I thought these things that I didn't see elsewhere were not only academically interesting, but I was finding them helpful in figuring out how to preach it to my church. And so I began to pursue that. That led to me doing a master's thesis on that and then deciding to follow that up with doctoral work.
Good. And you did your doctoral work at Aberdeen.
That's right.
You studied with Howard Marshall, a name that many of our listeners would be familiar with. Tell us a word or two story, perhaps, about Howard Marshall.
Yeah.
He's been with the Lord now 3 years, is that right? 2 years? How long?
About 2 years, I think.
Okay, 2 years.
He was a great blessing to me. To be able to work with him was one of the great values of being there. I didn't know that when I went. I just knew, hey, this would be an opportunity. This is a prominent scholar. But the personal interaction with him was very significant because he was such a humble man. The students around would actually talk about that or swap stories, and was greatly appreciated. For one, he was a committed churchman, and being a Methodist, he went to the little Methodist church there in town, and it was well known amongst the students that for years he taught the equivalent of what we would call RAs. So the boys Sunday evening class. And so here's this world-class New Testament scholar. What's he doing at his church? He's teaching young boys, teaching the Bible, and playing music and working with them. This is a little to the side, but I use that sometimes in talking to students when I encourage them. They've got to be involved in the local church or their classes are going to be meaningless. And sometimes they'll say, well, there's nothing for me to do. And I say, well, what you mean is there's no leadership position for you to have. Mm. There's always something to do. Show up and volunteer to empty the garbage cans. We just be there, be a part. And he was a great model of that in various ways. When I went over for his funeral, for example, I had the privilege to speak at it. And there were some people who came up because I said there, I'm normally in academic settings where I tell people, hey, you don't know what a churchman Howard Marshall was. But since I'm here at his church and I've listened to a few of you, you may not realize the world reputation of this man. And I had people come up to me afterwards and say, we had no idea. He would drive with us on Sunday afternoons for us to go preach, lay preachers in the Methodist tradition. And he would drive us there and talk about our sermons and help us with them. If we had known he was this world-class New Testament scholar, it probably would have scared us to death, but we never knew. So it says a lot about his humility and his love for the local church.
That's fascinating. And what a titanic figure he was. The pastoral epistles, we understand something of your academic journey into them. I guess I would just ask you similarly, how did your love for the pastorals develop? What has drawn you to them and then back to them again and again and again over the years?
Yeah. Part of the beginning is what I mentioned of coming out of that sermon series. And even before that, I had a sense that an academic realm was a part of my calling, but then the connection with pastoral ministry or training for pastors. And even though I didn't realize it as it was developing, what I can see looking back is the pastoral epistles were a great place for all of that to come together. Doing academic work in them, and yet the focus or the so much of what's there talking about ministry, it was an ideal place for these interests to come together. And then they're just so rich. In some ways, in the academy, overlooked or despised, mm-hmm. actually. And so that richness of how the gospel must shape our lives, some so helpful practical things about healthy church and healthy ministry, it's such a rich mind, can't help but keep going back and back to it.
Yeah, for me, the pastoral epistles, and by that, of course, we mean 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus. For me, those were instrumental in my own call to ministry. I felt the Lord call me to ministry in college. I'm wrestling with that call. I'm praying through that call. I'm seeking wise counsel about that call. And Romans chapter 10, I was drawn to again and again and again. And then alongside that was 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus, again and again and again. And reading through those, and obviously, especially the qualifications for ministry, 1 Timothy 3, 1 through 7, Titus 1, 6 through 9. And man, that was liberating for me when I read where Paul wrote, if any man aspires to the work of overseer, it is a fine work he desires to do. Mm-hmm. And it arrested my attention because I had this longing for the ministry, this desire for the ministry, but I felt a little bit guilty about longing for the ministry.
Right.
Is this a healthy feeling or not? Is this mm-hmm. a healthy ambition or not? Is this a healthy drive or not? And when I read what Paul was saying, and then I was also given a copy of Spurgeon's lecture to my students where he famously says, you know, the first sign of a call to ministry is an intense, all-absorbing desire for the work. And to me, it was liberating because I saw not only is this desire for the ministry, not only is that negative, but that actually is an indicative of a call to ministry, and it was liberating. So the pastoral epistles are special to me along those lines, and they are, I suppose, to most every preacher. I said this morning in chapel and introduced you kind of jokingly, I said, every self-respecting preacher loves the pastoral epistles. And there's just a sense in which we can identify with what's going on. We've right. all been Timothy at some point in our lives, in our ministries. We all see within these books challenges that the contemporary church faces. We all see sticky issues in our own ministries we've had to deal with. And so they're instructive, but they also are just so encouraging. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I didn't mention it, but when I was finally gave in, it really was surrender, and for me, to a call to ministry. It was at a centrifuge. We talked about the University of Mobile. That's where it was. Mm-hmm. And the cinching point was the emotional thing they had for us to work with that week was on 2 Timothy. And it was in reading 2 Timothy 4 one morning that I thought, okay, yeah, this is what I'm supposed to do.
That's great. Dr. Van Ness, let's pause just for a moment for a word of update from Midwestern Seminary.
Midwestern Seminary's 81-hour Master of Divinity degree prepares you for ministry today and tomorrow. Midwestern Seminary's flagship degree program is our primary track for ministry preparation. Requiring only 81 credit hours, the MDiv program is an efficient option for students, equipping them to serve the church in pastoral ministry. Residential students will be trained in a unique community environment passionately focused on the local church. Online students can earn the full degree without leaving their current ministry context. Come be a part of one of the fastest growing seminaries in North America as we develop a new culture of discipleship devoted to the local church and committed to taking God's unchanging word into a rapidly changing world. Visit mbts.edu/mdiv today.
All right, we're back with Dr. Van Est here on Preaching and Preachers talking about preaching the pastoral epistles. So preaching the pastoral epistles, help us to know, Dr. Van Est, are there any kind of macro themes that you would encourage preachers to be mindful of? Is there studying those books, preparing sermons, any macro themes to really keep their eye out for?
Sure. There are some that people tend to think of. They tend to think of pastoral ministry or the church, and of course those are there. So I won't pursue those, and people tend to think of them, and we need to think of them, continue on that way. But sometimes people think that's all that's there. And I would argue perhaps the biggest theme, at least one of the biggest themes, is actually the connection between doctrine and ethics. I said this to an ethics professor years ago, and he was talking about something about biblical-based ethics, and I said the pastoral epistles were a key source. He said, well, for pastoral ethics. No, you haven't read these letters. Through all three of them, there's this intense concern that if we really understand the gospel, we have proper doctrine, it has to shape our lives. And I think a lot of people miss that. You can find it all throughout, but the place that I guess especially caught me, and if somebody just wants to look at one place to figure it out, look at Titus 1:16 and chapter 2, verse 1. And remember, of course, that there aren't any chapter divisions originally. 1:16, he's finishing his discussion of the false teachers in there. So here's what they're wrong about. But he says, they profess to know God, but by their deeds they deny him, being detestable, disobedient, unfit for any good deed. Pretty strong statement. Chapter 2, verse 1. But you teach what is fitting for sound doctrine. So when he goes on with chapter 2, he's going to list ethics. If you look in most of your Bibles, including the ESV, above 2, 1 to 10, it's going to say sound doctrine. That paragraph's not about sound doctrine. It's about sound living. But his point is, in 1, 10 to 16, there's a kind of living that proves you're not a Christian no matter what you say. 2, 1 to 10, there's a kind of living that affirms a profession of faith. So there's a strong discussion there, and it's such an important message that our churches need today, that if we are converted, if we know the gospel, it has to shape our lives. It's not a thing about you get saved now, and if you decide to be serious about this, it may change your life later. And if you just read the pastoral epistles, that message is clear.
Okay, excellent. So doctrine and ethics, is there another theme that we should be out looking for?
A variety of things about age in the church, or age groups, and in gender groups as well. People will think of 1 Timothy 2 right away, and of course that's there and important. But bigger than that, when you get to Titus 2, if people know Titus 2, they probably think about women's ministry, and that's good. But it's also there about older men, younger men. I think we would do well to think about the church as a body and how we interrelate and see some of these discussions to see that godliness, there's a similarity of godliness across the gender and age groups, but there are distinctives too. A godly older man looks a bit different than a godly older woman. And we could use to think about that and tease that out. Or if you look at the discussion of widows in 1 Timothy 5, what this godly woman looks like, which I may need to come back to this, but let me tag on then another theme. What I call, I borrowed this from somebody else, I'm sure, but the earthiness of real spirituality. I tell students a lot that I think sometimes we try to be more spiritual than the Bible, which is then a wrong spirituality. And you can see it in a lot of places, but that discussion of the widows is a great one. He's going to say the church should support true widows, which are godly women. There's another piece to it, but that's the central one. How does he describe a godly woman? Maybe not the way we'd expect. He talks about tangible, nitty-gritty service. He talks about bringing up children, washing the feet of people. This day-to-day ministry. He does mention prayer, but I think very often our idea of spirituality is somebody who's shut off in a room, doesn't interact with people, prays and reads their Bible all day, maybe a holdover from monasticism. Paul's description is somebody who's knee-deep in the messiness of life and is helping and serving. I think that could be a helpful corrective to us as we think about spirituality.
Very helpful. Any other major theme you want to mention before we move on?
That's what comes to mind at the moment.
All right. So with these themes in mind, any general words of counsel you would give preachers as they preach pastoral ministry? So you want to keep an eye out for these themes. Obviously, in addition to these themes, issues of leadership, local church, preaching the word, Timothy vacillating the faith, verse by verse, other considerations to keep in mind when one preaches the pastoral epistles.
Yeah. Well, I think this is true of other places, but I think you can do this more than one way. Paragraph by paragraph is kind of standard we talk about with expositional preaching. You can take bigger chunks and smaller chunks. So today in chapel, I took what is in most English translations about three paragraphs. Don't just look at a small piece. Try to get the flow of thought. I think we miss a lot by not catching the bigger picture. So, for example, oftentimes, back to Titus 1:16 and 2:1, people will see Titus 1:10 to 16, false teachers are bad, okay? So I'll preach, don't listen to false teachers. Chapter 2, 1 to 10, we should live a certain way. Okay, I'll preach ethics. But if we miss that flow of thought, we miss this very important point that really understanding the gospel has to shape our lives that I've already talked about. So I think one of the biggest things I would mention is give a real attention to and try to give a focus to the flow of thought through the whole letter. That's not unique to the pastorals, but make sure you catch each paragraph with how it relates to where the whole letter is going. That not only keeps you from misinterpreting a paragraph, but it will bring out a lot of riches as well.
So as you do that, I guess conceptually a bigger question to ask is, why the pastoral epistles? In other words, you could be preaching Mark, you could be preaching Acts, you could be preaching the Old Testament. Why would you encourage pastors to preach the pastoral epistles, especially perhaps someone listening is thinking, well, that's really about leadership, about qualification of ministry. It's about the local church. There's not a lot there for the average people in the pew to get out of it. What would you say to that, to that comment?
Well, thanks for that question, because that's one I try to hit often. I would even say that these letters are not primarily written to pastors or about pastors. They are written to men who are filling a pastoral role, but it's written to them about the local church. So most of the application, or the most direct application, will be for Christian living. It's just so rich on Christian living and what we should look like. What should you look like as an older man? What does it look like interacting with different people? If I have true doctrine, how should it shape my life? How should it shape our worship services? That's really the bigger picture of 1 Timothy 2. All of these things, I would want to press them to say, if you thought this was only about pastors, you've really missed it. This was intended to be overheard. We could talk about technically why we can see this, but intended to be overheard by the church in Ephesus, by the church in Crete, which, by the way, Ephesus is a well-established church Crete is a brand new church in a fairly pagan, immoral setting. I would venture to guess that most pastors who are listening right now are either in churches mm-hmm. that are well-established or in churches that are new and oftentimes, I mean, pretty much anywhere in America now, an increasingly pagan kind of society. So all kind of connections, all kind of resonance. And I think one of the, I'm repeating myself here, but one of the biggest issues in our churches today is this thought that you can be a Christian without it really shaping your life. And these letters are going to just come back to this again and again. If you want to disciple your people, if you want your people to live out their faith, the whole Bible's there for you, of course. But these three letters are big on that point.
Mm. That's very helpful. Well, listen, time is flying by here, but perhaps just one more question or two. Is there anything pastors should steer away from? By that I mean, is there any common misinterpretation, any common misunderstanding that you kind of cringe when you hear someone say or preach? Give us a word of warning here.
Yes, that's a good question, and I should think more about that. The first one that comes to my mind is not a major doctrinal point, but in 2 Timothy 1, where Paul tells Timothy to fan into flame the gift of God which is in him, I wanted to preach that text this morning too. People often will say, yeah, Timothy was this timid person and all, and that's what I cringe about. We have no evidence of that. What we have is Paul telling him to strap it on, hang in there. That doesn't mean he was timid. That means he's in a difficult setting, and he's doing what any good football coach does with his team before. He's saying, it's going to be tough, but I want you to strap it on and do this thing. So we all not badmouth Timothy in that. When we do, I feel a little bit bad. I think we may be slandering a brother from long ago.
Right.
But I wonder if also we blunt the point of the text. If we end up thinking, well, that's for timid people, and I'm not really timid. Nah, it's for all of us.
Very well said. But listen, Dr. Van Ness, as we pull this together here, what resources out there, and in particular, I'm teeing you up to comment on your own. Nope. Where can they get your commentary or anything else you've done on the pastoral epistles that may be especially helpful?
Well, there's a couple chapters around different places, but an article I wrote on Titus, the overall letter, the message of Titus, I called it, is in the Southern Baptist Theological Journal, and you can search and find that online. And there, what I'm trying to do is get the whole picture of the letter at once, and I think that's helpful for preaching. It actually grew out of me preaching in one sermon the whole letter, but you can break it up in pieces. So hopefully that would be useful. As far as my work, the other thing probably directly related to that is in a new volume that'll be out soon on the background of the letters, it will cover the whole New Testament. My portion will be the pastoral epistles. For other resources, I think key commentaries, John Stott's work as usual mm-hmm. Is really good. He has on 2 Timothy and then 1 Timothy and Titus together. Bill Mounts' commentary is a bit more technical, very solid and faithful. Howard Marshall's, again, is a bit more technical, but up to date on the most things, though I will differ with him on some key issues. Those are the ones that come to mind as particularly helpful, and Phil Towner in the International Commentary Series.
Tremendous. Thank you for being with us today here at Midwestern. Your chapel sermon was most helpful, and just great to have such a warm-hearted believer, warm-hearted academic on the campus. Most especially, thank you for being on Preaching and Preachers.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Preaching and Preachers. For more information, please visit my website, jasonkallen.com.